I'm Marianne Kolbasek-McGee, Executive Editor at Information Security Media Group. Today I'm speaking with Dr. Kurt Roloff, who is co-founder and CTO of Duality Technologies. We will be discussing potential future outbreaks of public health emergencies, such as bird flu, and the challenges involved in securely collecting, integrating, and sharing this data for real-time decision-making. So, Kurt, so far, we have not seen any reports of human-to-human transmission of bird flu, but humans who have been exposed to infected birds and other animals have gotten sick. This even prompted New York State's governor to recently order a temporary shutdown of live poultry markets after bird flu was detected in one of the outer boroughs of New York City. With this all said, what are some of the potential challenges that you're seeing when it comes to collecting and integrating data in a private and secure manner from health agencies, market inspections, and other entities? And how can integration of this data enhance surveillance and enable quicker response to emerging threats like bird flu and other public health concerns?
It is really basically a perennial question for challenges associated with public health and other kinds of medical events and medical emergencies. One of the challenges of medical data processing is that it is highly regulated, meaning that there's all sorts of concerns about HIPAA and other kinds of abilities to legally share data. In addition to that, it's also a moral imperative that we respect the rights of privacy of the people around us. And so basically, when we need to share data, or when there is a high benefit to share data for the greater good, for the greater good of society, such as for public health, there's an understanding of proportionality, meaning that the need to share this very sensitive data has to be balanced against both the risk of leakage and impact of leakage of that data, and also the risks associated with insights that might try to be obtained from that data, such as the existence of public health emergencies, such as the propagation of bird flu. So up to now, there's been a very, very high, rightfully so, I should say, very rightfully so, a very high legal bar associated with the sharing of legal data and the protections of that data when it's shared. This has, of course, caused friction and has basically made public health organizations generally fairly slow in responding to public health issues, and also has made them basically less effective in responding to public health issues. And so this is basically up to now been a very unfortunate balance that we had to obtain. And what we decided in our society, you know, as a rightfully as a democracy, as a societal decision, is to try to find a balance. And basically, by restricting more data, of course, don't get the insights. But by more freely sharing the data, there's potential impact, not just on individuals, but also legal liability impact on the folks using that data too. And it's a fundamental friction point that we have been dealing with up to now. But you know, just a little segue a little bit. We're starting to get a handle on about how to do it better with less legal friction and more effective use of data.
So when you say we're starting to learn on how to do this more effectively and in a private, secure way, what sort of advancements are you seeing or do you potentially see?
Basically, there's been basically a push over the past several decades to develop more secure data collaboration technologies. And this is especially accelerated over the past decade of development of a set of technologies called privacy-enhancing technologies, otherwise called PETs. These privacy-enhancing technologies basically allow the ability of organizations to provide access to information obtained from data. And fundamentally, for public health and public health insights, public health and individuals might not actually care so much about the medical situation of specific individuals, but they might care, for example, about the instances of certain kinds of diseases at specific locations, whether it's neighborhoods, blocks, or certain demographics of people. And so, what we can do with these privacy-enhancing technologies is basically to collaborate on data. And so, for this is, for example, doctors' offices can collaborate with public health government institutions to derive insights from data in ways that protects the privacy of the individuals and protects the security of the underlying medical files. And so basically, this is basically a very nice beneficial situation where we can get the best of both worlds. And this is, of course, being driven by not just the technologies themselves, but increasing regulatory and policy acceptance of the use of the technology. For example, in the UK, there's an organization called the ICO, Information Commissioner's Office, which regulates the use of data in the United Kingdom, good upstanding democracy. And the ICO has, after several years of study, has come out with very firm policy positions that privacy-enhancing technologies do provide a way to both protect data and gain insights for public health, for instances of identifying financial crime and fraud and things like that, for the public good, balanced against protections of privacy of data. There's been similar movement in recently in OSTP, Office of Science Technology Policy, in the executive branch, who has taken very strong positions recently about the acceptance of privacy technologies as a means to protect sensitive health information also. And so this kind of regulatory policy acceptance has driven practitioners, people on the ground, to develop techniques, technologies, systems to better collaborate on data that are just starting to roll out into the world as they are.
So when it comes to some of these efforts, what are some of the technologies that are being deployed in this area?
So one of the more common technologies that might actually exist, for example, on the laptop that you, if you're working on this on a laptop, is a set of technologies called trusted execution environments, often abbreviated as TEEs. A lot of the modern Intel, AMD, and related kind of commercial CPUs have basically trusted modules inside the chips where there's a very kind of, almost like a cryptographic strong box inside the chips themselves. Intel's technology is called SGX and basically allows the processing of data while it's encrypted. And these technologies are widely deployed across commercial cloud environments. For example, AWS has their Nitro system, and there's a few others. And basically, this allows for very wide-scale processing of data very securely with very strong guarantees from some of the most trusted vendors of technology in the world, while also at the same time, there's software vendors, Duality, my company included, that are building software on top of these trusted execution environments to make them much more usable by public health practitioners and other kinds of data users and data engineers, as they are also. And there's a family of other technologies that I'm also very supportive of, technology, for example, called fully homomorphic encryption, where if you don't have access to these special compute environments, allows for data to be encrypted basically anywhere and then hence protected through software only with very, very, very strong guarantees about the protection of the data when it's encrypted, but still allow computation of the data while it's encrypted also. There's many more, but those are probably the two most prominent that exist and are being used in the world right now.
With federal workforce layoffs and cuts underway at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and other health agencies, it's difficult to say how this may impact surveillance of bird flu and other public health concerns. But with that said, what sort of data collection, sharing, and integration challenges could you potentially see in all of this, if any?
One thing that I like to point out is that a major benefit of these privacy technologies is that it allows, sensitive data users or regular data users to be much more effective financially in terms of the ability to not just access data, but also process data. So, for example, less time has to be spent by lawyers ironing out things like data use agreements and memorandum of understanding. It's easier to get through IRB, basically review boards, to approve the use of data. And so this basically means that when a study is funded or budget is allocated for public health, much more of the funding can go to actual data collection and actual data processing and less spent on administrative overhead, such as these various kinds of data use agreements, because of regulatory acceptance and things like that. And so basically allows us all to be much more effective with less and have basically researchers and scientists and public health professionals be able to come to conclusions much more quickly much more cost effectively as it is.
So now, Kurt, how might cross-industry data collaboration between agriculture, transportation, healthcare, and other industries improve surveillance of bird flu and other evolving public health concerns? And what's needed to enable this sort of secure data sharing across industries without compromising sensitive information?
It's one thing to kind of start with a very focused approach of collecting, for example, health information in a specific city, a specific borough, a specific block. It's another thing to aggregate that behavior and aggregate that data across multiple industries. And although, health information is very, very sensitive and very rightfully so, and needs to be very well protected, that doesn't mean to say that there aren't other very sensitive data that can be shared to get a better public health view of the world. Example that I like to point to is company information, that companies basically have their own competitive positions, they have their business processes, they have their customer lists, they have even, very, very sensitive information about financial transactions that have occurred. This is all very, very sensitive information too. Some, of course, more sensitive than others, but companies, generally would at times rightfully be hesitant to help with the surveillance of basically of public health emergencies in their infancy, and we could detect them more quickly, more easily, if companies are more comfortable sharing their competitive data, their information, if they were given very strong guarantees that their data wouldn't necessarily leak to the public or leak to competitors. And so we can help companies such as transportation organizations, such as corner stores, such as even vendors of, for example, poultry and things like that, by letting them share data more freely because we're protecting their sensitive information. It basically makes public health even more effective in identifying potential outbreaks at its source when it's much easier to take an effective intervention than if it were to propagate more broadly. So there's a potential huge impact of sharing more data, but of course, scaling data collection, scaling data types is a major engineering and research challenge for what it is. In some sense, that's the brave new wave of where we could be taking this technology, although it's not necessarily as rolled out as broadly as it could so far.
So, Kurt, as we know, there are a variety of federal and state privacy laws and regulations that do put restrictions on the certain types of sensitive data that can be shared without consent, without de-identification, and other sort of requirements. So, what sorts of federal policies and perhaps state policies might help promote public and private data sharing to enhance public health emergency response, do you think?
That's a great question, and it really depends a lot based on the kind of the federal regulations. It depends, of course, on the states. In our great country, we have a basic concept of federalism, where some powers belong to the central government, the federal government, and some powers also belong to the states. And this is fundamentally what we've chosen in our great democracy. And so, rightfully so, different states have made different decisions about the kinds of protections that they want to provide to their citizens' privacy. And that's, of course, great. But this, of course, causes the challenge of how do we propagate data across state lines, because public health emergencies don't respect geography. They don't respect legal boundaries in geography, like states and even cities and things like that. And so there is benefit from sharing across geographies. And there are a few ways that we can start to do that, such as, for example, provide, very, 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 very highly secure data protection technologies, such as the fully homomorphic encryption that I alluded to before, that basically can be used to span across geographies. And there's other technologies, such as federated learning, that would allow basically analysis to be formed on data where it resides in a state, in a city. So the data itself won't necessarily cross geographic boundaries, but the insights itself would. And there's been a general movement, of course, for broader acceptance of these privacy technologies. Some regulators have been much more accepting of trying things out. Some have been more hesitant. It's totally understandable. It's the way of the world. And I think by building visibility of the use of these technologies, to show to basically policy authors and to show to regulators that these technologies can and do work. These technologies can and do make government more effective and better provide for protections of the citizens of our great country and in the states and the cities as they are too.
And finally, Kurt, any key lessons that emerge in your eyes from the COVID-19 pandemic that might be helpful when it comes to secure data sharing and integration related to public health emergencies now moving forward?
COVID is a great example, and I think this has actually been driving a lot of thinking as we've seen overall. My particular take on it is that some kinds of data and some of the stewards of some kinds of data, such as cell phone data and things like that, were generally very, 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 very hesitant to share data during the initial COVID outbreaks, particularly for things associated with contact tracing and things like that. And one of the reasons for that is in my opinion, and was that previously some of the cell phone providers had shared some data in response to the 9/11 attacks. And basically, there was a bit of a reckoning afterwards for some of these cell phone providers, mobile phone providers, and things like that. That made them more hesitant to provide data in future kinds of emergencies overall. And so I think a good thing to do, and at the time, which is what happened, is that it was very unclear about what was acceptable in response to an emergency to share data, what was not acceptable to share in response to data. And the cell phone providers basically did not want to take on any additional liability like they did in response to the 9/11 attacks. So overall, setting at least initial policy frameworks, even if it isn't necessarily seen all the way through, as a way of better responding to emergencies, whether it's public health or other kinds of very drastic bad emergencies, basically can help to provide a framework and a general framework for data vendors, even if we don't know yet what kind of data we might need to share in future emergencies when they arise overall.
Well, thank you so much, Kurt. I've been speaking to Dr. Kurt Roloff. I'm Mary Ann Kolbaczek-McGee of Information Security Media Group. Thanks for joining us.